All right, Jamie, I hate being late because all the other people doing their podcast are already talking about crap that I was going to talk about, and it's going to sound like we're just copying them.
Okay, so you should know, this, our audience should know, that I never listen to anyone else or read anything else to prepare for our shows, so everything that I bring up is completely organic, and you should ignore anything that you heard, and I know you're an honest guy, you're like one of the most honest people I know, so I know that if you didn't think of something organically that you will not say
it. Yeah, but you can't help it. You get it in your head, and then it's not your pure thought anymore. You're like, oh yeah, now I'm blending what I've thought of originally with what somebody else has already said. Anyway, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. This is West Coast Project, Jamie, and this is the podcast for Better Call Saul Season 2, Gloves Off, 204, fourth episode.
That's right.
So, Jamie, I have some thoughts.
Give me your thoughts, Mike.
I like Jimmy's career arc. I like the Jimmy Kim romance arc. I like Mike's arc. And I really like the criminal looming, growing threat arc of Tuco Nacho cartel people coming. But I hate the Chuck arc. Just don't like the Chuck arc. What do you think?
All right. So, all right. I kind of like the Chuck arc. and I will explain that in a second. I love everything else. I think that this thing just hit its stride. I'm just so blown away because, you know, Tuco, who could ever not want to see Tuco, right? And Nacho actually just got really much more interesting to me. I love seeing characters that are typically one or two note characters fully fleshed. And that's what these guys do really well. These Breaking Bad BCS folks, they really do that fleshing out thing very well with their, typically these like gangster types and criminal types are usually one note characters, you know, but they're just, Nacho's just gotten so interesting to me.
Nacho's brilliant. It's too bad that he's got he may not have a limited run. We may get to see a lot of him in Better Call Saul. We didn't see any of him in Breaking Bad, so we know that his story arc ends somewhere along the line. Well, but he's the best. He's the most interesting character.
He's fantastic, right? I love what they write for him. I love what they write for him. And the actor, Michael Mando, he's so good. I don't know where we've seen him before. It seems to me like I've seen him somewhere before in something where he made an impression on me. But I can't remember right now exactly where that was. But he's so interesting. And
he's so different in the show than he is in real life. I've heard him on a couple podcast interviews, and he's like so sweet and polite and nice and gentle. And he's very, very dangerous looking in the show, and he's like super intelligent. It's like a super intelligent version of Tuco.
Yeah, I think you're right. This is fascinating. I'm actually reading about him right now. And he's really fascinating. He's a Quebecois. He's from Quebec City in Quebec in Canada. So he's Canadian. And he spent the greater part of his childhood in Africa, living on the Ivory Coast and in Ghana. So that's on the west coast of Africa. Before coming back to Canada, before returning to Canada as a teenager, he studied psychology in college and pursued a degree in an academic scholarship in international relations. Wow. I didn't expect that.
All right, Jamie, so starting this episode, it's a flash forward to Mike returning from this Nacho job that he gets involved in with Nacho. We ended the last episode with Nacho having a guy that needed to go away.
That's right.
So Mike's involved with this now. He spills the money on the table. It looks like $25,000. And he goes right for the cold beer and cold carrots.
Okay, so I thought it was 50. I thought it was 50,000 because that was the original agreement. The original agreement was 50,000 to kill Tuco.
That's right, but he didn't kill Tuco.
No, he didn't kill Tuco, but you said it looked like 25,000. But when I saw it spill out of that package, I just immediately assumed it was 50 because, you know, that was what he was supposed to get for whatever.
Well, we know now that he gets 25.
We do know that now. Oh my God.
Well, I'm saying it knowing it now. I'm not, you can't tell when he spills it out if it's 25 or 50 or 4580 right. $4, it looks like a lot of money.
Yes.
All right, Jamie. So the name game, gloves off. We learn a little bit about that. Even Mike's got some gloves in his hand, some jewelry.
That's what. Oh God, Mike, you just clarified that for me. I didn't. didn't occur to me that that was the gloves.
It's a little silver necklace, or it's part of his bolo or something.
Yeah, it's like something like that, yeah.
Some people have been speculating, like, was Tuco the Golden Gloves champion of his little town in Mexico, or did he win some sort of a boxing competition? Or is he just a ballsy, I'm going to wear whatever badass-looking gangster jewelry I can find?
I don't know. He probably got that. I mean, did he have that in Breaking Bad? Did he have those?
They say that he did, so they actually, he must have gone and gotten some more, because he has this set taken away.
Huh.
I don't remember seeing this necklace or this jewelry in Breaking Bad, but it's a pretty small piece of Tuco to remember. I remember his grill getting chucked in the river.
Yeah.
Jamie, you're typing with the twat hammer fingers.
Would you stop it?
When you type, it is like a it's like you're on a tom-tom drum. You need to isolate your microphone from your desktop.
I don't have okay, so I have a snowflake.
Snowball.
Microphone. Whatever that thing is. It just says blue on the little thing. The one you told me to buy when we
blue,
started.
It's a snowball blue.
Wait a minute.
But when you type... You can hear your fingers pounding away.
Okay, so is that bad?
Yeah, it sounds like. Hold on. I don't know if you can hear that. I'm touching the top of my microphone, but yeah, you can hear it. Don't you ever listen to our podcasts?
I do, and I don't mind the sound of me typing because it doesn't sound like that.
I've complained about it a number of times, Jamie.
No, you haven't.
Call in HR, Jamie?
Okay, wait a minute, Mike. You have not complained about me typing. You have complained about me hitting the table.
Well, anything that interferes with the microphone.
Oh, come on. The typing is not bad.
All right, Jamie. This Golden Gloves necklace thing goes right up to the credits, and we get a different credit this time. It's the drawer of phones. You think they're going to have a different one every episode?
I don't know, because I just noticed the thing with the drawer of phones. I just noticed that this episode, and I think that the last several episodes have been the same one, the same image, and so I don't know. And I'm wondering if they're going to start doing something cool, like having a slightly different opening when a different story arc takes off, or, having the openings, have some sort of relationship to the show and the story. I don't know. I have to go back and actually watch the openings of the other three episodes for the season, because I thought that they were all with the Scales of Justice. But perhaps not.
Not sure. I don't remember. Mm. All right, Jamie. So we go to the first credits and we come back, and it's the commercial with the woman from the nursing home or the retirement home, and the guy's descending with the dolly chair. They're using the chair climbing thing as the dolly.
Mm.
The film crew from New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
University of New Mexico. But it's Jimmy's review of his doing this video. Now, we're going to tangle some more here, Jamie, because I still don't think Jimmy did as much wrong as everybody else seems to think he's done wrong here. And he's not meekly folding and begging for forgiveness. He's doubling down. He's selling. He tells him the production costs were super low and it got good return, and he should be actually probably congratulated for doing this.
Well... I don't think he said that. I think he was a little bit more,
It's a tactic. He didn't say that, but it's his tactic. He's trying to take a good offense as the best defense.
Well, yeah, and the lady partner, I forget her name if we ever knew it, she says, would you stop selling or something? Or one of them says that, would you stop selling? You know, and which that was exactly what he was doing. And it made me sort of wonder if he was in the wrong line of business. I think he could have been a lot more successful as a salesperson maybe than he would have been as, you know, as an attorney. But yeah, I mean, you know, he was looking at the, you know, the very sort of, you know, marketing kind of, you know, what his bottom line is kind of, you know, angle. And I thought it was really interesting because that situation really resembled a lot of our back and forth, you know, in the previous podcast where you and I were sort of arguing exactly those points where I was representing, you know, Clifford's side of things and the law firm side of things. And you were of the opinion that what Jimmy did was not that bad. You know, and that it was really kind of good if you looked at it in a certain way.
Well, weren't you pulling for Jimmy, though?
So I'm always pulling for Jimmy. He's our protagonist. You know, I don't ever want him to, you know, get, you know, smashed. But, you know, I think what he did was stupid. And I think it was wrong. And I think he's really lucky that he didn't get fired.
All right, so here we go again. So I get hot under the collar when I watch this little scene because the main and Cruz seem almost nefarious, like we got to do it our way or it's the highway. I just don't like that at all, man. I started thinking to myself, you know, fuck these people, fuck this sideshow. I'd be out too if I had to jump through those hoops. And maybe it is arson. You know, maybe it is playing too fast and loose with an important career decision, but still I just did not like the whole feeling of you got to do it this way or it's not going to work at all.
Well, Mike, I mean, okay. So I would not expect for you to think any differently. Well, actually, okay. I can't say that because I'm a little bit surprised, at the way that you're taking this because I can see both sides of that argument in you. Like I could see you, you know, agreeing to that this is a crazy thing for him to do. But I'll say that you are a very independent person. You're, you know, sort of a renegade, you know, in a lot of ways. And, you know, you're an independently employed person. You don't work for people. You know, people work for you.
Couldn't they just say to him, Jimmy, you may be new at this corporate game.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I know what you're saying, you know, that you feel like they're giving him too hard of a time, but I just really don't. You know, I don't know that I would have kept him. I might have just fired him. You know, what he did was just, it was so reckless. And it's exactly, you know, like what I was saying. I mean, I don't think I need to really even comment on it if, you know, if people were listening to our podcast from last time, because exactly what I said is exactly what Cliff was arguing. He was saying the thing about, you know, the firm's image and their reputation and everything. And it's not, you know, maybe the commercial was not what they wanted, you know, to be their representative. You know,
yeah,
what
I get that. I get all that. Do you think this is the intention of the writers to have us say, Jimmy, you've pushed it way to the limit, dude. You did something you shouldn't have done. These people have a justified argument here. Or do you think the writers want us to think, God, what a bunch of asshole lawyers these guys are. I can see why Jimmy bails on this crew.
I think that the writers want exactly this to happen, like what's happening right now. You know, Vince Gilligan has spoken a lot in the past about not wanting to tell people what to think, not wanting to tell the audience what to think or what they should get out of something or what something means. He's a real proponent of having people draw their own conclusions. And even to the point that that people have asked, you know, like about the ending of Breaking Bad and what it meant. And he's been very loath to talk about specifics because he, you know, he doesn't like that. He wants people to have their own conversations about things. And, you know, the more I thought about what happened in that episode, it was so pristinely written and so perfectly laid out. You know, in so that we had every single ingredient we needed to be able to have the discussion and the argument and say, you know, go back and forth and say, well, no, that's not what it was. Well, that's, this is what it was, kind of thing. The exact discussion that we had on our podcast, and even more so last episode.
So do you think that's the writer's intention though? Like, okay, we got,
absolutely.
We'll 100%. Have 50% of the audience going, God, Jimmy, you're nearly on the edge of falling off the edge of the world here because you blew it, buddy. And the other 50% of the audience saying, go, Jimmy, leave these stiffs behind and blaze your own trail into criminal lawyerhood. Do you think it's 50-50, or what do you think?
I don't know anything about the criminal lawyerhood idea, but I believe that what they want is the conversation. I think that Vince Gilligan gets a kick out of having people discuss what the story is and what it means to them and what they took from it, you know, and I mean, really seriously, it was perfectly, perfectly, perfectly written for exactly what happened, because, you know, you and I were having that discussion, and like the deepest part of it for me, where it was probably the most interesting, is when we were talking about, you know, you were saying that, you know, you felt like it was too much management, that they hired him to come in and do this job, and then, you know, they're trying to micromanage him, and you think it's bad management. And my point of view was, well, yeah, I mean, you could argue that if it were not for the conversation that they had where Cliff Mayne said, you know, this is not my go-to and blah, 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 and I'm going out of town and blah, blah, blah. But the other thing that we didn't actually think of and talk about during the podcast is the fact that during that first meeting, the meeting where Aaron spoke and then Chuck gave that quote about, you know, vigilance and teamwork, or I don't know what the thing was exactly right now. But in that meeting, they were talking about Jimmy's job. And what one of the partners said was, well, that's your area, that's your purview, so we're gonna leave you to it. Like, basically saying, hey, this is completely hands off. We are not getting into, you know, your client acquisition area. We're leaving you to it. And for me, that argument means that they absolutely had faith in him. They were absolutely not trying to tie him down, that what he did stepped beyond the bounds of what he'd been hired to do. For you, that was probably, you probably took that a different way. And
no,
I
get it. I agree with you. I agree that he shouldn't rock the corporate boat and he should be careful. But I just don't like the way they talk to him. I don't like the way they talk down to him. And they don't, you know, usually when you want to be a good manager, you give somebody, like, you help them understand. You don't alienate them. And maybe they would have fired him in real life, and that would have not even mattered not to alienate. That would have done the ultimate alienation, right? You're on the streets, buddy. But I don't know. I just didn't like it. I and we can keep talking about it. And you're right, Cliff. What's his name? Who's the frickin' writer of the show? Vince has got us talking about it, and we're at odds over it. But I guess that's good. It is interesting that it's caused this difference of opinion.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's where the real sort of flesh of the whole thing is. I think that's where the enjoyment is, certainly for the writers, you know, to be able to have that effect, and, you know, for the audience to have something that they're still talking about a week after the show aired. You know, I think it's great.
People agree with your point of view here, Jamie. People are saying that law firms are the most staid, corporate, you know, conservative types of businesses ever. And back then, television was viewed as like a, you know, you're an ambulance chaser if you're putting out commercials. So a lot of, and there is not just one, that firm was not based on this one case. That firm had a lot of clients and a long future, and they didn't want to jeopardize all the years that they've already had been in business doing it the old-fashioned way. And, you know, that was the implication. You're short-circuiting our professionalism here, Jimmy, by running a television ad. We get business by referrals and our name and our reputation and all that. So I see it. I just don't like how they talk to him.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay, so that's the other side of, you know, being in that sort of corporate environment, though. Because he is not a new lawyer who's coming in there and expecting to be groomed, he is on the partner track. He has a greater degree of responsibility toward the firm because he's trying to gain some ownership in this firm. I mean, that's a big deal, and that's probably why it's so, well, you know, I mean, the appropriate name, Gloves Off. I mean, I guess it was, you know, maybe, you know, appropriate.
Yeah, double meaning, triple meaning, yeah. But I don't know, that's why he kind of got short-circuited into partner track, because he was kind of doing stuff that got noticed and did things a little differently, and now he's getting punished for it. And then maybe it's a little too differently, but...
No, he wasn't doing things differently. He was doing things that were brilliant. It doesn't mean that he was... What he did was he found a case. Like, he, you know, found a, you know, a something
he
that...
He found angles. I mean, it's not...
Not angles. He found...
Brilliance is always different, though. Brilliance is finding a smarter, different way of doing things in any endeavor.
Oh, okay. So, yes, you could say that in some ways, but this, again, is a different environment. It's not invention. This is not, you know, finding something new. This is...
Is that the car guy?
Mike.
All right, no. Jamie, let's just put this... Okay, we got to power through a little bit more of it because there's a Kim now with Howard and Chuck. But I don't think people want to just listen to us go back and forth and back and forth. So Kim and Howard and Chuck now. Kim's in trouble. So I got the same kind of situation here with Howard and Chuck now, especially maybe Howard and Chuck piling on. But she's in trouble for knowing something that she does not share, which also seems very weak to me. She can't have a personal thought that she doesn't share without getting in trouble. And I can see their side of it. She could have saved a lot of trouble by saying, hey, you know, guys, I heard this about Jimmy. You guys maybe want to know this. But that's kind of personal information that she got in a personal setting with Jimmy, and she's expected to have shared it now.
No, that's not it. That's not it at all. What it is that when you work for a corporation, you are expected to have that corporation's best interest at the fore, okay? That's why there are things like conflict of interest. And there are reasons why some companies do not allow personal relationships inside of the company. You know, people don't date or get married inside some companies because, you know, they're forbidden from doing those things because your personal interests then become more important than the corporation's interests. So, you know, there are all kinds of reasons to keep these things, you know, sort of separate.
Did this company have that rule? No personal relationships?
Well, I don't know, but that's not the point. The point is, why was this a problem for Kim? And you're saying, you know, this was something that was personal, that she shouldn't have had to disclose it or shouldn't have been expected
to. I'm saying she found it out under personal circumstances. She found it out after hours at Jimmy's apartment or her apartment, whatever. They're watching a movie or something. She didn't find it out in the course of her daily work. She knew some things that were related to work, but she found them out under personal circumstances.
Yeah, that doesn't matter.
Okay. I don't understand why it doesn't matter, but if it doesn't matter, then we don't have to argue. It just doesn't matter. She should have shared it.
Right. Have you ever worked like in a big corporate environment like that?
I've never worked in a big corporate environment. No.
That's why these things don't make sense to you, because that, like, I have and I do, and I'm telling you those things. I mean, there are a lot of these. The things that we're discussing are in your employment contract. Like, it gets deep.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. I mean, this little rabbit hole could go really deep. Like, what if Kim and Jimmy were married and she found out something that he did and didn't tell the firm, but she's married to him? Almost like incriminating him in a legal situation. She would not be expected to testify against him, for example, in court, but she would be expected to testify or to reveal information in the corporate setting based on what her employment contract was?
Well, I don't know. And I don't know that anyone there is aware that there's any sort of, you know, beyond, you know, friendship level kind of, relationship happening between Jimmy and Kim. And I can't speak about that. I would imagine that the law of the land is, takes precedence over any kind of corporate policy in a situation like that. But I think what the issue was that this was something that was detrimental and is seen very clearly as being detrimental to, Clifford and Maine. Is it Clifford and Maine?
Clifford and Maine. It's something else in Maine. Davis and Maine. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's seen as being detrimental. It's seen as that she had knowledge of it before the commercial aired, and she did not reveal the fact that she knew that the commercial was out there.
Right.
And that's the problem for them, and I can understand it. You know, and because she didn't speak up and say, well, I didn't know this or I didn't know that, it makes her look like she's got very bad judgment, like she knew. Like, you know, right. Like Jimmy walked up and said, hey, I've got this secret commercial I made. You know, what do you think about it? And instead of Kim, you know, going and saying, hey, you know, Jimmy's made this commercial, you know, she kept his secret for him. So it makes her judgment look bad.
Right. So she's in trouble. So when she leaves Chuck and Howard, she's angry, but she's angry at Jimmy, not at them for making her. Putting her on point for not having revealed this. She doesn't really have an argument with them. She's really angry with Jimmy.
Yeah, and probably with herself, yeah.
Okay. Nacho next lays out... Now, let's get into this fun stuff, Jamie. Stop arguing with me. Okay. Nacho lays out the plan for Mike, and I love this part. I love this part, man, where it's, okay, well, here's the restaurant, here's what they do. Although they do one little thing that's the trope I don't like, where in broad daylight, we're invisible, we're standing across the street, nobody can see us looking at the restaurant.
And I was thinking that the whole time. Why doesn't anyone think there's anything wrong with them standing out there in the broad daylight in front of the restaurant?
And was Tuco in there at that time?
No, he wasn't in there, but he should have been. I mean, for all the evidence that they were just presenting to the world, why not?
All right, well, there's some cool stuff to this plan. They talk about it, and Nacho tells Mike that there's a meeting every so often, every couple days a week or whatever, with the partners in Tuco's little enterprise to deliver the drug money. And the restaurant, Jamie, is the El Michoacano. The Michoacan is a state in Mexico where the cartel started. So it's really cool that this restaurant is named after it. Wow. And on the Insider podcast, the Insider guys, Vince Gilligan and crew, talk about how that's where the cartel, that's where the Salamanca cartel started. So they used this real world, real life history that... this Michoacan province in Mexico where the real cartel started, they connected up to this story in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Tuco has a pretty cool ride, pretty cool car. What'd you think of his car?
Okay. It was blue.
It was what?
It was blue.
It was purple, wasn't it?
I don't know. It looks
like... Maybe you're right. It was like metallically blue, purple, blue.
Like indigo, like an indigo colored blue.
Hamlindigo?
Maybe.
it was a Buick Skylark or a Cutlass. I couldn't tell which. They were kind of the same, you know, General Motors version of that same car. But it was a really, really cool old muscle car. And the deal is at these meetings, Jamie, is there's cash deliveries, a lie detector, a count, and then the dealer, the runners leave. So the lie detector is Tuco essentially glaring at the person. Mm-hmm. Putting the heat on him with his eyeballs while they sit there across the table from him.
That's right.
So Nacho wants Mike to kill Tuco to make him go away. Pull up when the runners leave. You pull up as the last one leaves. Is Tuco get into his car? You pull up next to him. Boom! Shoot him in the head. You're 8 blocks from I-40. You're a ghost. You're gone. I liked all these details that Nacho had already researched and knew and had gotten and lined up for Mike to kind of sell him on buying into this deal.
Yeah, that was interesting. You know, all the work that Nacho had done, and he was, you know, ready. He had all the kind of all the corners covered.
Mike's concerned about the escape. They get down to a kind of a funny little point, like, what if my car's blocked in or my car doesn't start? And Nacho just says, well, then you just run. And Mike says, bad knees. He's got an answer for every little scenario that might develop if he were to accept this job.
Yeah.
But then he starts thinking about it longer term, which also introduces a few more interesting concepts into this deal. He's worried about Nacho being able to keep the secret if they do pull it off and he escapes. The bigger concern is Nacho might not keep the secret. Might get back to the cartel.
What? No. Nuh-uh. That's not what he was saying. No, he was saying that if Mike kills Tuco, then it's going to be a danger for Nacho. Because the word would actually get back to the cartels, of course, that Tuco's been killed. And causing that kind of upset means, like, all the cartel is going to descend on Albuquerque looking for the person who's responsible for killing
Tuco. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I just said. The secret, Nacho would not be able to keep that secret. There wouldn't be a secret to it. It would be Nacho would somehow become implicated in it because he was his partner. Nacho would not be free from this crime of Tuco being killed, even if he doesn't kill him.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, I thought you meant that he might tell.
No, the secret would get, this plot would get out.
Okay, I gotcha.
Yeah, and then we find out in the future, and anyone who's watched Breaking Bad knows that's exactly what does happen. When Tuco gets killed, spoiler alert, the whole Salamanca clan descends on the scene to find out who killed him and take care of that person, and it's a bunch of trouble.
Yep.
Yeah, so Nacho does show that cool skull scar embedded under his skin from Tuco going nuts on some guy.
That's right.
Some guy he actually liked.
Yes. That was so crazy. But that's
now,
Tuco.
They talk about that guy. That guy was named Dog Paulson. And Hank, when he's breaking down the case in his little DEA office, mentions Dog Paulson to his crew when he's going through one of his insanely funny rants to his team there about how Tuco knocked off a guy named Dog Paulson. And that was his buddy. That was Tuco's buddy that got him mad for some 1 minute, and he ended up killing him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so Tuco's on crank and about to graduate up to Crystal, and that's why Nacho's worried. He's just he's a short, hot-blooded temper, and now he knows he's Nacho, of course, knows what he's involved in. He's involved in selling these other drugs that Price had, so he doesn't want Tuco to find out and essentially have the same thing happen to him that happened to Dog.
Right. Yeah. So Dog, Tuco was on crank, on biker crank, when he killed, what they call it, peanut butter or something like that?
Peanut butter crank, yeah.
Yeah. When he killed Dog. And now he's on Crystal. And that's why Nacho is afraid, because he knows that even though he's close to Tuco and they're friends and they work together, it doesn't mean anything. If he's using and he gets upset, his loyalty to Nacho is not going to matter.
Right. So we learn some more about Mike. As Mike processes this job, like, okay, how could I do it? I drive up next to him, blow the guy away, and sitting next to him in the car. How about a sniper from over here? There's a clear 1,000-foot shot. And Mike and Nacho talk a little bit. We realize through this that Mike was a sniper in Vietnam. This is some new information about Mike.
Okay, so I didn't take that from the conversation, but when Mike met with the gun dealer guy in the beginning, there was a lot of talk in that conversation about military weapons and, you know, what happens when you use those weapons in the field. And so that made me believe that Mike had a military background.
Yeah, that's after this. That happens after this.
Oh.
So a couple things in this conversation help us understand this, Jamie. One is Tuco, Nacho essentially just saying, can you make that shot? And Mike says, yeah, I can make that shot. So he was like a Marine sniper or some sort of an Army sniper in Vietnam. Mm. And it's just cool to see more of Mike's background get revealed slowly but surely as they talk about this potential crime that he would become involved in for the 50,000. And it's just neat to see it all get processed and reveal at the same time, reveal this new information to us.
That's pretty cool.
All right, Jimmy goes now to the Hamlin office to help save Kim based on all the stuff getting out and Kim getting in trouble. And he walks across the floor at night, and Waldo tells him not to slip. That's an interesting little comment. Don't slip, Jimmy.
Oh, slipping Jimmy.
Yeah. Jimmy meets up with Kim, and she's pretty cold to him, but interestingly implies that they're not completely finished off yet as a romance. Well, now, why didn't she just fire Jimmy at that point for fire him as a boyfriend?
I don't know, but that should tell you something. This is probably revelatory about our relationship and about, like, you know, how we see things, because I was really irritated with her. I was irritated with the writers, actually, that they made that choice for her. I thought that there were two things that sort of knocked and clanged, like, really badly in that bit of story. And part of it is that she's not done with him. She's not even pretending like she's done with him. And, you know, the other thing is that he says something to her. When he says in that conversation, oh, so we're not done? Like, we're not done now? Or something like that.
Right.
She completely, it's a non sequitur. She completely leaves that. She doesn't even answer that. She goes to something completely else and offers that as a response to what he has said. She doesn't address it at all. And I thought it was a real cop out, and it was irritating to me.
Interesting. I think this is really complicated, but it's deliciously complicated. And it's interesting to me, you're taking it, Jamie, that you can see how Clifford Maine could fire Jimmy right on the spot, right, like this, but Kim doesn't fire him on the spot. I guess maybe you're having the same argument here, is like she should have fired him on the spot. She should have just said, dude, we can't do this anymore.
No, you know what? Because if it were me, I don't know that I would have fired the guy on the spot. I probably would have, but I would have been more upset with him than she is. And I don't know why she's not. Maybe she's blaming herself because she may know him better than we know that she knows him. I don't know.
That's why it's complicated, though. That's why it's good. That's why it makes it good, makes it interesting. Why doesn't she just say, Jimmy, you screwed up my career. I can't even talk to you. I don't ever want to see you again.
Well, it's not even that. It's not even the idea of him screwing up her career, because she could, hopefully get something back on track. And, he hasn't burned it down completely. He hasn't completely committed arson against her career. But, the fact that he deceived her the way he did is what's problematic for me. Like, in this scene. Yeah.
I guess he does deceive her by not telling her that he didn't have the approval first, which she kind of asked him, I guess, during that evening.
Well, not only that, but, when he got into trouble with Cliff on the phone, he pretended as though the conversation wasn't going the way that it was. Even after the guy hung up in his face, he pretended they were still having a conversation. It was a complete deception.
Right. Yeah, that is true. So why doesn't she dump him? It's pretty complicated.
Dump him or be mad? Something.
She's pretty mad. She tells him to go away. I don't want to have you here now.
Yeah.
She covers it up with needing to do work, but she doesn't want him around her.
Okay. Well, maybe.
All right, Jamie. Now Jimmy goes to Chuck. When he goes to Chuck, he unloads everything of his electronics gear into the mailbox. Why don't you just leave all that crap in the car? I've always wondered that. Why do you have to take it out and put it in the mailbox?
No, I don't know.
Leave your phone in your car.
Yeah, you're right. I don't know why.
All right, Chuck is hurting. He looks like he's got the flu or something. He's just shivering and hurting. What do you think is going to become of Chuck before we talk about this little scene? What's going to happen to Chuck?
I don't know. I think Chuck is going to be fine. And, you know, my opinion is sort of colored by this scene. So, you know, I can wait a few lines or I can tell you now, you know, what I think about his illness.
Tell me.
Okay, so I think that Chuck is probably ill. A lot of the reason why Chuck is ill is because of his history with Jimmy. I think that Jimmy's inability to stay on track and his special penchant for wreaking havoc and burning things to the ground and not having any sort of concern or protection for the people that are closest to him when he does all the destruction that he does, I think probably has had a great impact on Chuck. That's my opinion after this particular scene. And, you know, and I wonder about that because we don't see their parents. We don't know the story about their parents, do we?
I don't think we do.
So I'm wondering if their parents didn't maybe die young or if there was some sort of situation where it ended up that Chuck was responsible for raising Jimmy and Jimmy's personality being what it is, that maybe it didn't just cause all kinds of problems for Chuck and that it didn't impact his own development because, you know, if he raised Jimmy or was responsible for Jimmy from a young age, then it probably impacted the person he is too. And his, you know, super ultra leaning toward following the rules and doing what's right all the time and seeing Jimmy as being a chimp with a machine gun, you know.
So you said Chuck is ill. Do you think he's resentful? Do you think he's physically ill or do you think he's mentally ill?
I think he's mentally ill.
Yeah, I think so too. Because he recovers from his quote unquote illness as he gets more, like when he's in the office, he's wound up, or when he's arguing with Jimmy and he gets wound up, he's not hurting anymore. He's fine. He's just, he gets all passionate and he's animated. He moves around well. He's not shivering and hunkering under that Reynolds wrap thing. So he's fine when his mind is distracted from whatever he thinks he has.
I think you're right about that.
Jimmy Reynolds wraps him up a little bit and they talk and get some water, and he's a pretty loving brother for all the things that Chuck is mad at Jimmy for. He's lucky he has Jimmy around to care for him like this.
Yeah, and I think that that Jimmy is also lucky to have Chuck, even though Chuck, you know, doesn't have the best reputation with viewers right now. I think that they're both lucky to have each other. And the fact that they lean on each other the way that they do, it tells me there's something deeper. There's some more history there that we don't know.
Probably. I mean, hopefully we'll find out. Mm-hmm. I like how Chuck oohed and aahed a little, like when somebody gets tucked in with a super thick, nice comforter when he put that Reynolds wrap layer on him. Mm-hmm. He snuggled up with it. That was funny. All right, Jamie, now we get to see Jim Beaver is lost in the gun dealer. Mm-hmm. Of course, we know that he was in Breaking Bad when Walt tried to buy a gun or did buy a gun.
Right.
But I think this helps us understand Mike's history. Mike was probably in Vietnam. He was probably about 19 or 20 when he was in Vietnam with the gun that the third gun that Beaver shows him is the gun that he most likely used in Vietnam with a wooden stock and not the polyester or whatever plastic stock that this one had. Because mm-hmm. He talks about it, like when you take a gun like this into the jungle with water and heat, you get warpage, and that's what happened. So you know he used that gun before, and he was probably using it as a sniper in the war. Mm-hmm. That gun that he ends up liking is the M40A1, and he holds it and kind of looks down the sight and holds it again like he recognizes it, almost like an old friend. Mm-hmm. But then, interestingly, when he wipes his prints off that gun, his fingerprints, mm-hmm. we know right away that means no deal. I'm not gonna be taking this baby with me. And he offers Lawson some money for his trouble, for coming out and showing him the guns. And Lawson turns that down. I think that's a great business tactic. That's a great marketing move by Lawson.
You know, I actually thought of you when I watched him do that. Because I know that you're like this brilliant businessman.
Oh,
and
God. So wait, you're going to actually agree with me on something here?
Mike, I agree with you a lot. I'm just differing with you about that thing, but it doesn't mean I want to differ with you. It just means we have different opinions. I have a lot of respect for you, dude.
All right. But I really like that Lawson says, nope, no trouble, buddy. Just call. I'm doing my business by referrals. And you know he's going to go right back to Lawson when he needs another gun.
That's exactly right. And I like how they've written this guy because he really is like he takes his business seriously. Like, I love how he got into that detail about with the shaving the serial numbers off and how he does the extra stipple, random stipple thing so that if they try to recover the serial numbers that they'll still be confused by it. It's not close to perfect. It's not perfect, but close, kind of thing. That guy really takes his work seriously.
And the writers did their work seriously, digging that deep down to figure out that if you stippled the metal, you wouldn't be able to drop a chemical on there and see the remnants of the serial number.
Right. So cool.
All right. So we jump from Lawson back to Chuck in the morning. Chuck wakes up. Jimmy stayed with him all night. Jamie, I still want this show to cycle through Chuck. I hope Chuck's not around for much longer. I just don't like him. Because he immediately becomes dislikable again. I don't know if he's doing it on purpose or not, but it's effective. He's not very likable. He asks Jimmy for tea, and then he just rails against him some more for the way he is with his career.
You know what? I am absolutely fascinated in hearing your take on this stuff because you really don't see some things that happen, and I pick up on things that and gloss over other things. And I think that our takes on stuff are based on they're based in our own personal psychology, like what actually makes an impact on us. You know, for me, I've got a huge thing about loyalty. And like the second biggest thing in my life probably is following the rules, doing what's right. Right. So for me, when that whole thing, the chimp with the machine gun thing happened last season, I was horrified by Chuck. I wanted to erase him from the show. I didn't want to see him again ever. I hated him. I couldn't stand him. And we talked about all of that, in our podcasts for last season.
We even showed the video of the chimp with the machine gun.
That's right. You did. You brilliant man. And so this, I was really shocked. It was so interesting to me, this episode, when that thing came up again, and this time I was on Chuck's side, and I could see why he was having these problems with Jimmy.
All right, so tell us.
Well, I mean, Jimmy really is like a chimp with a machine gun. The dude, you cannot give him a bit of power or ammunition because he will go off in all directions with it without any consideration for anything that's around him. And it was fascinating to me because of the parallel that was drawn about Tuco and what Tuco did to the guy he shot, to the dog, the guy that he ended up shooting, because that's exactly what happened. Do you remember what Nacho said? He paused in the middle of that story when he was describing to Mike what happened. He paused and said, I was behind him. Meaning, Tuco pulled out a sawed-off shotgun and blew this dude's head off. And Nacho was behind Dog. He could have easily killed Nacho. In fact, Nacho was wearing a piece of this guy's skull permanently in his collarbone. And it didn't occur to Tuco at all, that there would be literally collateral damage, as a result of his behavior and his choices. And that's not a mistake. Like, that was on purpose.
Well, that's an interesting analogy that Tuco is essentially Jimmy pulling the gun and blasting away. mm-hmm. regardless of the consequences. That's an interesting take. That is a pretty good catch.
Thanks.
I just don't like Chuck the way I could use some tea, and then he just rails. You know, I just don't like the way that people communicate with each other.
Okay.
Right? So if you're going to fire him, fire him. He's a professional. He can take being fired. Fire him. Don't coddle him and then talk down to him and be condescending. And Chuck kind of does that to Jimmy. That's the part I don't like.
So what part did you feel was, like, condescending and coddling?
Well, he accepts all his graciousness. Like, thanks for – he doesn't even really thank him for staying all night with him. Right? You know, he doesn't really say, Jimmy, man, I love you as a brother. I really appreciate you staying here and watching over me. But your career is on its last threads of survival here. You got to do this thing to save it. Or you got to move on from it. I'm really concerned that you're going to do something harmful to yourself and to this firm. He doesn't talk to him like that. He just talks down to him. That's what I don't like.
Well, I don't know that he's talking down to him. I think he's angry. I think Chuck is angry, and I think he should be angry. I mean, I think that, you know, if you are that guy who is responsible for this person, and that's really what it is. I mean, Chuck feels responsible for Jimmy, and Chuck is to a large degree responsible for Jimmy because Jimmy makes him that way. And, you know, and maybe their history suggests it. Maybe their history, you know, is the thing that is missing that would make us realize that this is, you know, the rhythm of their relationship. But for whatever it is, Chuck is responsible for Jimmy.
All right, but you don't tell your brother you're a chimp with a machine gun. That's just tasteless. There's no tact, right? If he really loves him and he wants to save him, if he's alienating him, if he's disdainful for him and he wants to alienate him, he doesn't care, fine. Look, you're a fucking chimp with a machine gun, dude. I'm glad to be done with you. But he's his brother. He should not talk to him like that.
All right, so I can see how you feel. I can understand how you feel. And in fact, last season when this happened, I love that they're being so brilliant about this. Because last season when this happened, if you go back and listen to our podcast, I was so upset. I was so horrified. I was emotional about it because I was so angry at what Chuck did. And right now, they got me because I'm so shocked that now I really understand where Chuck's coming from. It's a matter of perspective.
All right, Jimmy's mad that they tackled Kim and got Kim kind of out of her office and disrupted her career track. And Chuck blames it on Howard. That's another thing I didn't like about Chuck. He kind of blames this all on Howard. And they talk about being a puppet. I don't know. What did you think about that? Is there any part of this that makes you see Chuck as just like being a – Chuck is really pulling a lot of strings here. He really does have Howard kind of on his lap as a puppet, I think.
Okay, so that is the other side of this, and I just love it. I think these people are so freaking brilliant. In fact, the thing that's so brilliant to me about this is that Chuck is not this, you know, standing in the sun sort of virtuous fellow just because it turns out that he was right about Jimmy. He's still exactly who he is, which is kind of this kind of smarmy kind of guy from one angle, and a super ultra powerful guy who people are afraid of from another angle. He's still that dude, you know, and I love that because he's real. I mean, the character is real. Chuck is not perfect. He's not this lovely, wonderful big brother who's just there to rescue Jimmy and give him good advice that doesn't get taken. He's that kind of asshole dude, you know, that we saw last season. But he also is justified in some of his reactions and his actions. So, yeah, I thought it was really smarmy. Like, if you remember how it looked, the meeting that Howard had with Kim and then Chuck was just sitting there, in that meeting, it just felt kind of funky. And I don't know if you remember how it felt in that meeting, but, you know, Howard came off like an ass and so did Chuck. And
Howard was on as much trial as Kim was. Howard was sitting there being judged by Chuck as he was talking to Kim and reprimanding her for not telling them about this whole thing. He was on stage as much as Kim was.
Right, so it was crazy, right? And then I loved the line, actually, between Chuck and Jimmy, where they're having this conversation and they're doing this rehash. And, you know, Jimmy says the thing, you know, can he talk if you drink water? And then, you know, and then Chuck is like, you know, his reaction is kind of like, you know, almost like there's a part of him that is willing to admit that Howard is his puppet. And then there's that line where he says something like, yeah, well, you know, from what I understand, Kim is the one who, you know, forced Howard to, you know, give you a chance or something like that. So he's just repeating gossip, basically, which it's true. But I just liked it because it just gave so much perspective. It's really what they've done is give us that feeling of like being a fly on the wall, like almost like people might want to have in real life, like that situation where, you know, maybe you could see every side of the story if you got to see every person's part in it, you know, like what happened when the story got told to this person or what happened when that thing took place and nobody was there, those two people or, you know, whatever it was. It's kind of cool. It's almost like fly on the wall.
Yeah. All of these arguments are kind of blurring together for me. I didn't make enough notes to cover all these points, but Jimmy talking to Chuck and Jimmy talking to Chuck and Howard, I mean, he's just trying to get the one thing I like about all this is I like Jimmy just being right to the point, and this is his being an arsonist maybe, but he's, you know, he says to Chuck, come on, Chuck, commit a felony, you can do it. You know, he tries to bring him down to like the base level, like you can do it. Just do what you really want to do. You're manipulating everything to get what you want. You're trying to put Kim on the line, so I have to, you know, get squeezed out. But just do what you want to do. You can do it, Chuck. He tries to bring him down to his level.
Okay, so I really would like to say a lot more detail about that monologue, because it was so much more worthy than just, you know, a few sort of passing comments. And I don't have the text of it. And I don't want to bang on my keyboard, but I would love to see if I could find the actual text, like the actual
words. Yeah, I don't think we need the actual verbatim. But Jimmy pretty much says, hey, I'll quit if you put Kim back to where she was. Because she doesn't just get a slap on the wrist. Her career, her position is moved. Literally, she's moved out of her office, and her role has changed because of this. And Jimmy says to Chuck, you know, put this back. Put her back into her track, whatever her track was, and I'll quit. I'll stop being a lawyer.
Okay, so what was fascinating to me about that is that, I mean, it was just such brilliant writing, and the acting, my God. Bob Odenkirk is just so good. Who would have thunk it? You know, this guy who's like this comedy writer is just such a brilliant actor. I loved him. I loved him. In this scene, he was so great. And, you know, and it was, what it was is that he made the perfect argument for Chuck. Like, he's basically saying, this is the difference between those two men. This is what it is about Jimmy that is just so infuriating for most of us to witness. You know, when he says, what is it? He says, all right, I'll quit the law. He says, give her job back and I'll quit the law. Oh, yeah, make a deal. He says, Chuck says, this is not, let's make a deal. And Jimmy says, yes, it is. And the way he says it is just so perfect and so passionate. And it was weird because it took me out of the scene. When he said it, I lost my suspension of disbelief, because what it did was it put me in mind of this brilliant actor and trying to figure out how he got that to sound so right coming out of his mouth. Because it sounded so perfectly frustrated and so just dead on. It was such good acting. And And that's it. I mean, that's it, and that's the crux of it right there.
Well, Jamie, you're almost proving my point here, because Jimmy's a great arguer here. He's a great debater. He's a great lawyer. He gets Chuck to the point where, like, dude, here's what you need to do if you want this. If you want to win this case, this situation, this argument, just do this, and you'll win it. He brings all the terms down to everything that's basic and understandable, and gives Chuck this choice that, hey, pick door number two. This is a deal. You can pick door number two, and you get what you want. It's committing a felony because Chuck paints it that way, right? I'm coercing you to do something to get something else. You know, he's making Jimmy admit to some things to put Kim back on our law track. But he manipulates this whole scene. Jimmy does, makes this whole scene come true this way. I mean, he's a brilliant lawyer. And that's why I think these lawyers at this old Maine and Davis and Maine need to say, look, all right, we've always had our leadoff hitter bunt to get on first base, but here's a guy who hits a triple. Let's let him hit a triple. It's not something we've done before. It's not something we're used to doing, but this guy's brilliant. Jimmy is a brilliant lawyer. He's rocking a boat, but he's still a brilliant lawyer.
God, Mike, this is fascinating for me. This is fascinating to hear you have this conversation. It's fascinating. He's brilliant, but he is absolutely an arsonist. This is what he's burning the thing to the ground. He would kill his own career and his brother's at the same time, because there is nothing that Chuck could do to survive after committing a felony like that. I mean, that there's no way that wouldn't come to light. His career would be destroyed. And not only would his career be destroyed, but Chuck would be destroyed, because Chuck is an idealist. He's a guy who wants to walk. He wants to see himself as a good guy. He wants to walk on the right side of the street.
I don't think Chuck wants to have himself seen as a good guy.
Oh, I think he does. I think he wants to be seen as a powerful guy. And by the way, I wanted to tell you, you made a brilliant observation last podcast, and I don't know if you realized how brilliant it was, but you were talking about Chuck being in his house in the dark, and you were saying Chuck is in his powerless house because it had no power. But in fact, Chuck is this powerful, powerful dude who's like allergic to the power, and he's in a house that has no power. And I wonder how much metaphor and how much connection is tied up in that.
I think there's going to be an irony that's going to be really fascinating. And maybe this is just a blind ass prediction, but Chuck, I think, is going to do something that brings down Hamlin or Davis and Maine or something. He's going to screw something up with his insane frickin' allergy to electricity. That's going to bring down the law firm. And meanwhile, Jimmy will be long gone, of course, probably from then. But there's an irony here, just cooking and baking, and it's going to come out of that oven, and Chuck's going to be the cause of it.
Well, I think that is part of the irony. I think the irony is that this guy is so powerful, but he lives as though he's not, and literally as though he has no power. You know, that, I think, is a huge irony. And you brought it up. Like, you actually talked about it last time, but I don't think you were thinking of it from that angle.
Well, yeah, I'm brilliantly an idiot. So Jimmy is, I don't know, arsonist is the right word for him, but he's nuclear, man. He's got so much power that it's hard to contain. He's got so much, I mean, if he was channeled correctly, he could be a brilliant lawyer. And I think part of the job of this law firm or the people that hire him or whoever he works for, if he were to find a job in a corporate law firm, if they could harness that power, they'd have a brilliant asset on their hands. But nobody wants to do that. They don't want to break their status quo of the way that they do things and change to accommodate Jimmy. And I can see how he'd be dangerous and all that, but I think it's a mistake to let a guy like Jimmy go when he's got this much talent.
Okay, so... Here's the thing. When Jimmy is out on his own and he's working for himself and he has no one to tie him down, he does not achieve success. He really burns his stuff to the ground. He really succeeds in ruining his career and his life and destroying the thing that made him feel so proud and so happy, because he's not in control. He's not what he is. It's not, he doesn't need to be harnessed. He needs to harness himself. He needs to actually have the right priorities and do the right things, but he doesn't.
Okay. I mean, I can't argue with that, because that is what happens to him. But I'm just saying, in the right situation, somebody recognizes Jimmy's talent, it could have been managed and channeled into a productivity that just skyrockets. And nobody's willing to do that because they have their quote-unquote rules, which I guess are understandable, but it's a missed opportunity for this immense talent that becomes Saul Goodman.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You're preaching to the choir in a sense, because I always thought that. I mean, in fact, I don't remember when it was. It was one episode of our podcast last season where I said, you know, this guy with a little tweak could be a real true Renaissance man. He could be the guy who has the talk show, and he's a fashion icon, and he writes all these books, and he runs this huge law firm, and he's this super, super successful, unstoppable guy. With a little tweak, Jimmy could be that. I said that last season, and I still think that's true. I just don't know how anybody would ever put a bridle on
that. Well, that requires its own brilliance and risk-taking. These guys just aren't willing to take that risk.
What about Jimmy, though?
Jimmy's only truly bad idea, Jamie, was laser tag.
No, let me ask you, though. Like, what is his responsibility in this?
Well, a lot, but Jimmy doesn't have the cooling tower for his radiation, right? He's the nuclear core without the cooling tower. The management team should be the cooling tower that channels his energy into the power that becomes immense and valuable. He's reckless. He's a loose cannon. But if you put a nice base on a cannon, it shoots a cannonball pretty damn straight. And nobody's doing that. Jimmy's just, you know, ultimately we all are responsible for our own career paths and direction. But nobody recognizes that about Jimmy. They just think the recklessness overwhelms the brilliance. And I guess I wish somebody would see the brilliance as more. The value of capturing the brilliance is worth that risk.
Okay, but this is where you and I differ. Because Kim saw the brilliance, and she stuck her neck out for him. She really, really put herself on the line for him. And Jimmy loves Kim. Like, he really cares for her. But even that amount of caring for her was not enough to stay his hand. He still did what he did. So I don't know that anyone can contain Jimmy.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll see. I don't know if we'll have the chance, because he seems like he's past this point now. He's gone pretty far off the rails. Where I don't know if we'll ever get the chance to see somebody have a sit down with him and go, dude, this is what's going to happen if you don't do X, Y, and Z. He's kind of past X, Y, and Z now.
That was last episode.
Well, she makes some introductions for him, and she gets him opportunity, but she doesn't sit down with him truly, truly, that we've seen, at least in scenes or in episodes, where she says, dude, you have got to do this way and stop doing it that way. I'm your friend. I need you to sit down and tell you this and have you understand it. I'm your brother. You need to understand this. Chuck hasn't done that.
Okay, that we've seen. Kim did that twice. Kim did that twice last episode. She actually sat down with him and said, you cannot do this when it comes to your career. You have to do the job right. You're reflecting badly on me. It's a risk for me. But you have to do this for you. This is the right thing to do. She sat him down.
Well, I guess we're seeing the one-hour television show version of it, where we can only get to see, you know, 40 seconds of it at a time. But I guess that's what I'm missing in this, is that it doesn't seem like somebody's really said, and maybe that would not make much of a drama. That would be kind of a tedious thing to watch. But, you know, you screw up one more time and you're going to be out on the streets without a job.
That was this episode.
Yeah, but that's after the crime, after the problem, after the mistake.
Okay, so that's even more of a chance.
But that's too late.
No, it's not. Because he was warned beforehand. He was very well warned beforehand. But he didn't listen. And so now he's gotten burned by fire, okay, the fire that he set. And now he was told, listen, dude, everybody in this room wants to fire you except me. I'm the one that's saying you deserve a second chance. I'm giving it to you. This is it. Do not mess up again.
Right. But I'm feeling already what I know Jimmy in the show must be feeling, like, screw this crowd of straight-laced conservative stiffs. I feel that way. I can see how Jimmy would feel that way. I don't want to be part of this party anymore.
Well, there's your answer.
Yeah.
There's your answer for why no one can sit him down and say, hey, dude, you know, this is your chance, you know, you to be brilliant and, you know, just you have to operate within these parameters. It's because when Jimmy's going to hear that, he's going to be like, screw that. Why do I have to do that?
All right, Jamie, if you think I have crazy theories about Jimmy, I've got more.
Okay.
Okay, Mike and Nacho have a meeting. And they meet in a giant old-looking outdoor-y, indoor-y-looking building. Is that a giant chicken farm? It's got, like, chicken wire and wooden stakes, and it looks like the chicken farm.
I didn't even think about it.
I thought maybe this is Gus and Poyos before Gus is in the Poyos business, but would Gus have to already have been started in Poyos Hermanos at this point? Is this pre-Gus and Poyos?
Poyos Hermanos is old. It's been around for a long time, remember? Because even in the memory, when the character Max Arseniega, the Gus's guy friend, that when they went back to the old, Don Eladio? When they went to Don Eladio back in the day, like way, way, way back.
Yeah, I know that's old. I'm talking about when Gus had his chicken business in Albuquerque. Southwest.
I know. Poyos Hermanos was in existence then, when they went to Don Eladio way back then.
Right, but Gus didn't have a giant chicken business yet. He had the idea of a little chicken restaurant back then.
Well, I mean, but it was around then. So I don't know.
I'm asking goddamn Chuck on my mind. If Gus had this business up and running in Albuquerque and the Southwest at this point in time when we're seeing Jimmy and Kim and all these people.
Right. I say yes, because Poyos Hermanos has been there for so long.
How do you know that?
Okay. So when he was meeting with Don Eladio, he was already in the United States operating his business. And I believe that the only place that he's operated, like the only place where the business was actually housed, not that they didn't have offices in other states, but that I think the only place it ever was in Albuquerque. So I think Gus is in Albuquerque, and I think Poyos Hermanos is in Albuquerque right now.
Right, but Gus didn't start Poyos Hermanos with 28 stores across the Southwest. He probably started one restaurant with Max and then one restaurant in Albuquerque when Max was gone. It started small. He didn't have a gigantic chicken ranch that he had when he held those meetings with the cartel and stuff. So I'm wondering when did he get big enough to have that giant chicken farm, of which this may be the meeting place that Mike and Nacho are now in?
I don't know.
Would those two have overlapped? Or is this even a chicken farm or just some stupid building somewhere?
I don't know.
It's not worth arguing about because it's probably the latter. It's probably just some building out in the desert somewhere.
I don't know.
But this is where we hinted about it earlier. But this is where Mike explains the real problem. And that's the secret getting out that, you know, Tuco can't just go away. If Tuco goes away by being killed, it's going to come back down on Nacho, whether Mike kills him or Nacho kills him or whatever. Mm-hmm. I also wonder, did I ask you this? Why doesn't Nacho just kill him? I thought about that.
No, you didn't ask me that, but I think that probably Nacho is probably really afraid, you know? I think that he probably knows there's a lot of risk involved in him doing something like that. It would probably certainly point to him. And, you know, he'd probably risk, you know, the revenge of whomever. It's too risky.
Okay, so we now know Tuco is in trouble because he goes and beats up Mike and takes his wallet, essentially robbing him, which the police would see. And then he has a firearm, and he's a felon. So he commits a felony with the possession of a firearm and is going to be in, what, 5 to 10 years in jail, essentially.
Hold on. Did we just miss part of that scene? I think we missed something. Did we talk about that, or did you notice the character who was there, or am I too?
No, we're just talking about the thinking, the train of thought that Mike has when he talks to Nacho.
Okay. All right.
No, we didn't miss the next new exciting character.
Okay.
Although we do know, I guess we could talk about him now. They have the meeting at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And Tuco, by the way, backs into his spot, totally gangster. Mm-hmm. Only gangsters back into parking spots.
Right. So I'm so gangster.
You do that with your...
my Link.
Buick Skylark.
I don't drive a Buick. Although Buicks are pretty cool cars. That's not what I drive.
All right. Do you want to
drive a very, very powerful car.
Do you want to describe the scene since you're ready to tee up this new character?
All right. So Tuco backs in his badass indigo blue car. And they're sitting in the restaurant. And Tuco and Nacho are both facing out toward the street. And Nacho says that Tuco thinks it's kind of, you know, like gangsta, but he knows it's just so that Tuco can see his car. He just wants to be able to see his car. And in comes, they're sitting in there, and there's someone there. There's a dealer there who is turning in his money for the week. And the camera shows the face of the character after showing him in profile, and then we realize who it is. Or like me, when I first saw him, I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, who is this? I know this guy. And it took me a few to finally remember who it was. But it is Crazy 8.
Yeah, that was awesome. He looked like a little baby face, Crazy 8.
He did. And did you see the Tampico truck and his uniform that said Tampico Furniture on it?
Yep.
That was so awesome.
Walt was shopping at Tampico for the baby crib, and he bought furniture for the other kids there before.
Not the bassinet, but like for a crib for Junior.
Now, Jamie, I play softball, and my number is 8, and my teammates call me Crazy 8.
Ah, that's awesome. With a K?
I don't know. I just hear it. I don't see it written.
That's awesome. All right. So I loved it. And I thought that Max Arcinega did such a great job.
He looked so afraid of everybody. He looked so deer in the headlights, quivering in front of Tuco there.
Yeah. He looked completely green. I loved it. And this is one of the few characters in Better Call Saul that really looks like that. He looks younger than he should, you know, than he was in Breaking Bad, because that's a problem I have with the characters I've seen so far. None of them look like they really are time-wise younger than they would have been during Breaking Bad. And I just keep thinking, like, a lot during this series, where's the Botox? Why aren't they using some Botox on these people to make them look younger? Because they do a good job with Jimmy's hair. Like, they make his hair fuller and appropriate for the time. Whatever the time period is for him.
Yeah, and they use shadows, too. Odenkirk looks pretty young in some of these scenes, almost like the right time reference for him to be 10 years younger, 12 years younger, whatever this is.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, I don't know. But yes, I loved that. I loved seeing Crazy 8 again. I loved seeing him play such an innocent, very truly innocent-looking character, and seeing him look so uncertain about things. It was such a treat. Yeah, I really loved that.
Now, Tuco looked pretty made up. He looked like he was wearing some pretty heavy makeup to look younger.
Okay, so I don't know. He's one of those ones that I'm like, God, pull out the Botox. Come on, man. I think they could do better with him. But Raymond Cruz has such a beautiful face. I think probably the actor would not want to, you know, to have to go through some sort of change like that in order to portray somebody younger. That would be my guess, is that he wouldn't want to do that. And probably the show wouldn't want to ask actors to do that. But yeah, he's fantastic. And by the way, since I'm talking about Max Arcinega, I wanted to ask you if you knew that bit of trivia about Max, the guy who plays Crazy Eight, that they loved him so much, that the writers loved him so much as an actor, that when they brought in and introduced Gus's partner, friend, slash potential lover during the time that they were over at Don Eladio's in the past, that they named that character Max Arcinega.
Yeah, the real actor's name. Yeah, that was cool.
No. Right, well, the character was named
the character
that
was named for Crazy Eight's real name in real
life. Right, yes, yeah. Yeah, perfect. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure you knew that.
I know mostly everything, Jamie. Except for, of course, everything about Saul and Jimmy's motivations. But okay, let's continue. They're meeting with Crazy Eight, and Mike pulls in, right?
Yep.
Now, this was an awesome driving. Mike puts his plan in play. Actually, before he drives in, he makes this payphone call from across the street, and he drives up, and he hits Tuco's car, but he barely hits it, Jamie. That is awesome driving to just barely nick the bumper like that. That mini hit is a really hard thing to do, I think.
Well, I agree with you. I think it was probably, you know, very extremely well planned. And that was another moment that actually took me right out of the episode, because I immediately started thinking two things. Number one, exactly what you just said. And number two, the character Mike, how much did he have to practice so that when he would pull in, that it would look exactly right like that. So effortless and perfect, but not really damaging.
Well, I think Mike and his character profile as Mike, Ehrmantraut, it's just like he's a perfect getaway driver. He's a perfect assassin. He knows all these hand karate, whatever, karate moves and stuff. But this driving was just amazing, the way he just nicks the bumper without really damaging the car, but enough to make it move a little bit so Tuco can see it. It was really cool.
It was cool.
Tuco's anger kicks in, of course, calls him Mr. Magoo, and Mike just bumbles his way up to the counter and buys a couple tacos and flashes some cash. And, oh, by the way, Jamie, in the Insider podcast, they do talk about color in this one, the color worn in this episode. Mm-hmm. And Nacho and Tuco are wearing the color of crime, red. Vince Gilligan actually mentions that. He of the opinion that color didn't really matter and everybody kind of read into it. He finally admitted that, yes, color was important in this one and red was the color of crime.
Okay, so I keep telling you, it's not that he completely dismisses it. He says that it has some validity, but it's not as intricate as people think.
Okay, well, I mean, there are people that post every episode color, the wardrobes people have. You can look at the chart through like all 64 episodes or however many there are, mm-hmm. like in a chart. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I thought that was interesting that they mentioned that the color red was important in this one.
He's mentioned the color red before. I think it was in the first, either the first or the second Insider podcast, he talked about the color red, and he said something specific about it. He said, for Better Call Saul, or in the Better Call Saul universe or something, red means blah, blah, blah. So this is the second time he's talked about color, and both times it's been red.
So they get into an argument. Mm-hmm. Mike reaches for his wallet, gets taken away by Tuco, and he takes his beating. Now Mike deftly knocks away Tuco's gun, which was, you know, not an old Magoo man move there. That was a pretty skillful way to knock away the gun. But he takes four or five pretty solid punches, broken jaw quality punches here coming from Tuco.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is the flash forward that we had seen in the very beginning, but another scene was where Mike meets Nacho and he pays him the money. We now know it's the $25,000 that we hinted at earlier. And then this is where these details add up. The wallet in Tuco's pocket, the gun in his possession. So Tuco's going to go away. He does go away the way Nacho wanted him to. And Nacho says, "You went a long way not to pull that trigger. Why did you do that?" Mm-hmm. Why do you think he did do that, Jamie? Mike's on some sort of a track here, too, where he's not quite where he was in Breaking Bad.
Well, okay, so I think that Mike, I've always thought about Mike that he has his own sort of, you know, ethics, and that he's you know, the best bad guy or the worst good guy, however you want to paint it. Mike has ethics. Like, he's an ethical dude. And, you know, it's just like when he talked to Jimmy episode 10 of last season, and Jimmy asked him why didn't they just split that money, the money from what were those people's names?
Kettlemans.
Kettlemans. The money from the Kettlemans, and Mike said, as far as I'm concerned, it was a job, and that's as far as it goes. That's why I didn't take the money. That's how Mike thinks. I don't think Mike was just a murder for hire kind of guy when he started out. I think Mike was a really idealistic guy and a very good, deeply good person, and somebody who had, you know, lines that he wouldn't cross. And I think that's why he didn't want to kill this guy. I think he felt like it was not a murder that needed to happen.
Yeah, the term half measure came to mind for me. Like, was this a half measure by Mike? And I tried to think, like, is Tuco staying alive? Did that ever have repercussions for Mike in Breaking Bad? I know it did for Jesse and Walt and some other unfortunate characters that crossed Tuco's path, but I don't think it ever did for Mike. So I don't think it was really, you can't really call it a half measure for Mike, because Tuco doesn't, the effects of not killing Tuco don't really harm Mike in the future.
Oh, by the way, since you brought that up, do you remember there was in one of the scenes this episode, early on, when they're talking about killing Tuco, Mike says to Nacho, "Are you sure you want to do this? Killing your partner, that's a bell you can't unring."
I remember hearing that, yes.
I loved that, because that's what Walt did. He killed Mike, and he couldn't take it back. It was a bell he couldn't unring.
Right, and Mike also got really angry when Walt suggested that they kill Gus after Gus murdered the guy in the lab, when they killed Gale, and then who's the guy in the lab? Victor. Gus killed Victor, Walt suggested to Gus, Walt suggested to Mike at the bar over a shot of whiskey, like, "Hey, kill Gus, and he's crazy, you know, kill him."
Yep.
And Mike got really angry about that.
Yep.
I wish I said that with less names and more sense, but... So it isn't really a half measure for Mike, I don't think, to not kill Tuco, but Tuco staying alive and going to jail connects a whole lot of dots, Jamie. Because in Breaking Bad, we learn that Skinny Pete and Tuco end up being jailmates, cellmates.
Yep.
And that's how Jesse, I guess, gets introduced to Tuco.
Mm-hmm.
Through Skinny Pete being his friend. So they're connecting some pretty cool cords and arteries and nerve endings here from the two shows. Pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah, I love it. It was really so cool, because I was watching, I don't know why, but for whatever reason, there is only one episode of Talking Saul on AMC right now. I don't know what happened with the episodes, because I don't watch television. And so I was on the AMC app trying to watch episode 4, and I saw that there was an episode of Talking Saul in there, and they were talking about, they got really excited. Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan were on there, and they got really happy and excited and talking about episode 4 coming up, and they were saying, get ready to start seeing some Breaking Bad alumni. So, you know, I think this is going to be the beginning of, you know, a nice walk down memory lane.
So let's speculate a little bit, Jamie. Jimmy and Saul, we know that Jimmy is a lawyer at this point in time. Mm-hmm. And we know that Saul has a law degree from American Samoa University. Mm-hmm. What happens? How does Jimmy, does Jimmy just change his whole identity to Saul and print up a diploma from American Samoa University? Or does he really go there and get a diploma? This is like Jon Snow, John Stark, Azor Ahai. Who is who?
Don't
and what,
talk
what,
about don't talk about Game of Thrones.
Well, I won't. But who? But it's like who becomes who and what becomes what in this? Does Jimmy cook up Saul from scratch?
I think he probably changes his name legally.
Interesting. And he just prints up a certificate that says the University of American Samoa.
Well, no, he probably sends off to the university and says, I've changed my name legally. I need a diploma that reflects my new legal name.
All right, so that's what I'm asking. So Jimmy McGill has a degree from the University of American Samoa.
Well, I mean, we know that. He graduated last season, remember?
I don't know that. That's what I'm asking. Does he have a degree from American Samoa or some other university in Chicago or Cicero or something?
Mike... There was an episode last season where he graduated from law school. He finally passed the bar. Remember?
I don't remember it being American Samoa.
Yeah, it's American Samoa.
Okay.
I'm so surprised you don't remember that. We really enjoyed that episode.
Okay, so when he changes his name, he just says, okay, Jimmy McGill, now Saul Goodman, give me the certificate in that name.
Yeah.
All right, I was just wondering. I just thought he had a different college, a different degree from a different college.
Nah.
Same degree from Durham College.
Mm-mm.
All right, Jamie, next episode 205 is Rebecca. Who the hell could Rebecca be?
I don't know.
Well, you know everything else. Come on.
Would you stop it? That is just messed
hey,
up.
Hey, how many episodes are there, 10 or 12?
Well, there were 10 last season. I only see 10 this season.
Probably 10 then. So we're almost halfway through, and there's a lot of stuff cooking here.
Yeah, Rebecca, I want to say that there's... Okay, so the episode that had the piano music, I think that the person's name on the sheet music was Rebecca something.
Ah, interesting. Chuck's piano book had that name in it.
I think so. I think so, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Okay. Any last thoughts for this episode, Jamie?
No, other than the fact that this series grows on me episode by episode. I love the writing. I think I just love these people so much. And before I become remiss, I would like to mention Kelly Dixon. I just have so much respect for her. She is the she's one of the editors. For Better Call Saul. She started off as an assistant, an editing assistant on Breaking Bad many years ago and came through and became a full-time editor there. And she is the person who started the Insider podcast. It was her idea to do that podcast, and it's responsible for my enjoyment of both of these series to such a great degree. I you know, and I've never mentioned her not one time, and I just wanted to take that opportunity to sort of give a shout out to Kelly Dixon because she's amazing, and I don't know if it's because I'm also an editor. You know, I'm not a video editor. I'm a writer and an editor, but I just really, really kind of I feel kind of a kinship with her, and I just wanted to throw her name out there.
Yeah, she has that podcast. It's really good. It's really interesting. And she's been in some other shows too. I can't remember them all. Maybe Jessica Jones? I want to say that, but it's probably not right. But
she's done some stuff for some other AMC shows too.
She's been in some shows that you'd recognize if we could remember them correctly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah, so that's it for 204 Gloves Off. And Jamie, a week from today, The American starts March 16th, Wednesday, on FX. We do a podcast for The Americans.
Cannot wait.
All right. I feel like we're leaving some stuff left unsaid about this episode.
I know, I do too, Mike. I don't know.
It's a half measure.
Okay, well then we're guilty of half measure. We'll have to shoot somebody and run over them at the same time.
You know, it's all going to come flooding in as soon as we hang up because this American Samoa thing bothers me. This whole thing about Tuco meeting Skinny Pete. It seems like we left that a little bit underdeveloped. Mike and his motivations kind of underdeveloped. But I guess we'll find out.
Okay, so then if we left anything unturned, then we will address it next time.
Okay, sounds good. All right, Jamie, how do people reach you if they want to talk to you?
I'm on Twitter, and I'm at WordGirly.
And I'm at SkathingTweets, and this is West Coast Project, and this is one of our longer ones, Jamie.
I know, I like the long
ones. We took the gloves off.
We did.
An hour and 40 minutes. Don't worry, I'll edit it down to under an hour.
All right, Mike.
All right, Jamie. See you next week.
See you next week.
Take care.
Bye.